Plate 83. Opuntia galapagia, James Island. See Darwin sketch. Stem 6 to 10 feet. Diameter 1 foot. Chapter 18. Plate 84. Ava orcava, Macropiper methysticum, Tahiti. Tahiti and New Zealand. Chapter index. Pass through the low archipelago. Tahiti. Aspect. Vegetation on the mountains. View of Amao. Excursion into the interior. Profound ravines. Succession of waterfalls. Number of wild useful plants. Temperance of the inhabitants. Their moral state. Parliament convened. New Zealand. Bay of Islands. Hippos. Excursion to Waymate. Missionary establishment. English weeds now run wild. Wai-e-o-me-o. Funerary love a New Zealand woman. Sail for Australia. October 20th, 1835. The survey of the Galapagos archipelago being concluded, we steered towards Tahiti and commenced our long passage of 3,200 miles. In the course of a few days we sailed out of the gloomy and clouded ocean district which extends during the winter far from the coast of South America. We then enjoyed bright and clear weather, while running pleasantly along at the rate of 150 or 160 miles a day, before the steady trade wind. The temperature in this more central part of the Pacific is higher than near the American shore. The thermometer in the poop cabin, by night and day, ranged between 80 and 83 degrees, which feels very pleasant, but with 1 degree or 2 higher, the heat becomes oppressive. We passed through the lower dangerous archipelago, and saw several of those most curious rings of coral land, just rising above the water's edge, which have been called lagoon islands. A long and brilliantly white beach is capped by a margin of green vegetation, and the strip, looking either way, rapidly narrows away in the distance, and sinks beneath the horizon. From the masthead a wide expanse of smooth water can be seen within the ring. These low hollow coral islands bear no proportion to the vast ocean out of which they abruptly rise, and it seems wonderful that such weak invaders are not overwhelmed by the all-powerful and never-tiring waves of that great sea, miscalled the Pacific. November 15, 1835. At daylight. Tahiti, an island which must forever remain classical to the voyager in the South Sea, was in view. At a distance the appearance was not attractive. The luxury and vegetation of the lower part could not yet be seen, and, as the clouds rolled past, the wildest and most precipitous peaks showed themselves towards the center of the island. As soon as we anchored in Matave Bay, we were surrounded by canoes. This was our Sunday, but the Monday of Tahiti. If the case had been reversed, we should not have received a single visit, for the injunction not to launch a canoe on the Sabbath is rigidly obeyed. After dinner we landed to enjoy all the delights produced by the first impressions of a new country, and that country the charming Tahiti. A crowd of men, women, and children was collected on the memorable Point Venus, ready to receive us with laughing merry faces. They marshaled us towards the house of Mr. Wilson, the missionary of the district, who met us on the road, and gave us a very friendly reception. After sitting a short time in his house, we separated to walk about, but returned there in the evening. The land capable of cultivation is scarcely in any part more than a fringe of low alluvial soil, accumulated round the base of the mountains, and protected from the waves of the sea, by a coral reef, which encircles the entire line of coast. Within the reef there is an expanse of smooth water, like that of a lake, where the canoes of the natives can ply with safety, and where ships anchor. The lowland which comes down to the beach of coral sand is covered by the most beautiful productions of the intertropical regions. In the midst of bananas, orange, coconut, and breadfruit trees, spots are cleared where yams, sweet potatoes, the sugar cane, and pineapples are cultivated. Even the brushwood is an imported fruit tree, namely, the guava, which from its abundance has become as noxious as a weed. In Brazil I have often admired the varied beauty of the bananas, palms, and orange trees contrasted together, and here we also have the breadfruit, conspicuous from its large, glossy, and deeply digitated leaf. It is admirable to behold groves of a tree, sending forth its branches with the vigor of an English oak, loaded with large and most nutritious fruit. However seldom the usefulness of an object can account for the pleasure of beholding it, in the case of these beautiful woods, the knowledge of their high productiveness no doubt enters largely into the feeling of admiration. The little winding paths, cool from the surrounding shade, led to the scattered houses, the owners of which everywhere gave us a cheerful and most hospitable reception. I was pleased with nothing so much as with the inhabitants. There is a mildness in the expression of their countenances which at once banishes the idea of a savage, and an intelligence which shows that they are advancing in civilization. The common people, when working, keep the upper part of their bodies quite naked, and it is then that the Tahitians are seen to advantage. They are very tall, broad-shouldered, athletic, and well-proportioned. It has been remarked that it requires little habit to make a dark skin more pleasing and natural to the eye of a European than his own color. The white man bathing by the side of a Tahitian was like a plant bleached by the gardener's art, compared with a fine dark green one growing vigorously in the open fields. Most of the men are tattooed, and the ornaments follow the curvature of the body so gracefully that they have a very elegant effect. One common pattern, varying in its details, is somewhat like the crown of a palm tree. It springs from the central line of the back, and gracefully curls round both sides. The simile may be a fanciful one, but I thought the body of a man thus ornamented was like the trunk of a noble tree embraced by a delicate creeper. Many of the elder people had their feet covered with small figures, so placed as to resemble a sock. This fashion, however, is partly gone by, and has been succeeded by others. Here, although fashion is far from immutable, everyone must abide by that prevailing in his youth. An old man has thus his age forever stamped on his body, and he cannot assume the airs of a young dandy. The women are tattooed in the same manner as the men, and very commonly on their fingers. One unbecoming fashion is now almost universal, namely, shaving the hair from the upper part of the head, in a circular form, so as to leave only an outer ring. The missionaries have tried to persuade the people to change this habit, but it is the fashion, and that is a sufficient answer at Tahiti, as well as at Paris. I was much disappointed in the personal appearance of the women. They are far inferior in every respect to the men. The custom of wearing a white or scarlet flower in the back of the head, or through a small hole, in each ear, is pretty. A crown of woven coconut leaves is also worn, as a shade for the eyes. The women appear to be in greater want of some becoming costume even than the men. Nearly all the natives understand a little English, that is, they know the names of common things, and by the aid of this, together with signs, a lame sort of conversation could be carried on. In returning in the evening to the boat, we stopped to witness a very pretty scene. Numbers of children were playing on the beach, and had lighted bonfires which illumined the placid sea and surrounding trees. Others, in circles, were singing Tahitian verses. We seated ourselves on the sand and joined their party. The songs were impromptu, and I believe related to our arrival. One little girl sang a line, which the rest took up in parts, forming a very pretty chorus. The whole scene made us unequivocally aware that we were seated on the shoulders of an island in the far-famed South Sea. November 17, 1835. This day is reckoned in the logbook as Tuesday the 17th, instead of Monday the 16th, owing to our, so far, successful chase of the sun. Before breakfast the ship was hemmed in by a flotilla of canoes, and when the natives were allowed to come on board, I suppose there could not have been less than 200. It was the opinion of everyone that it would have been difficult to have picked out an equal number from any other nation, who would have given so little trouble. Everybody brought something for sale, shells were the main article of trade. The Tahitians now fully understand the value of money, and prefer it to old clothes, or other articles. The various coins, however, of English and Spanish denomination puzzle them, and they never seem to think the small silver quite secure until changed into dollars. Some of the chiefs have accumulated considerable sums of money. One chief, not long since, offered $800, about £160 sterling, for a small vessel, and frequently they purchase whaleboats and horses at the rate of from $50 to $100. After breakfast I went on shore, and ascended the nearest slope to a height of between 2,000 and 3,000 feet. The outer mountains are smooth and conical, but steep, and the old volcanic rocks, of which they are formed, have been cut through by many profound ravines, diverging from the central broken parts of the island to the coast. Having crossed a narrow low girt of inhabited and fertile land, I followed a smooth steep ridge between two of the deep ravines. The vegetation was singular, consisting almost exclusively of small dwarf ferns, mingled, higher up, with coarse grass. It was not very dissimilar from that on some of the Welsh hills, and this so close above the orchard of tropical plants, on the coast was very surprising. At the highest point which I reached, trees again appeared. Of the three zones of comparative luxuriance, the lower one owes its moisture, and therefore fertility, to its flatness, for, being scarcely raised above the level of the sea, the water from the higher land drains away slowly. The intermediate zone does not, like the upper one, reach into a damp and cloudy atmosphere, and therefore remains sterile. The woods in the upper zone are very pretty, tree ferns replacing the coconuts on the coast. It must not, however, be supposed that these woods at all equal in splendor the forests of Brazil. The vast number of productions which characterize a continent, cannot be expected to occur in an island. Plate 85. Amio and Barrier Reef. From the highest point which I obtained there was a good view of the distant island of Amio, dependent on the same sovereign with Tahiti. On the lofty and broken pinnacles white massive clouds were piled up, which formed an island in the blue sky, as Amao itself did in the blue ocean. The island, with the exception of one small gateway, is completely encircled by a reef. At this distance, a narrow but well-defined brilliantly white line was alone visible, where the waves first encountered the wall of coral. The mountains rose abruptly out of the glassy expanse of the lagoon, included within this narrow white line, outside which the heaving waters of the ocean were dark-colored. The view was striking, it may aptly be compared to a framed engraving, where the frame represents the breakers, the marginal paper the smooth lagoon, and the drawing the island itself. When in the evening I descended from the mountain, a man, whom I had pleased with a trifling gift, met me, bringing with him hot roasted bananas, a pineapple, and coconuts. After walking under a burning sun, I do not know anything more delicious than the milk of a young coconut. Pineapples are here so abundant that the people eat them in the same wasteful manner as we might turnips. They are of an excellent flavor, perhaps even better than those cultivated in England, and this I believe is the highest compliment which can be paid to any fruit. Before going on board, Mr. Wilson interpreted for me to the Tahitian, who had paid me so abroad an attention, that I wanted him, and another man, to accompany me on a short excursion into the mountains. November 18, 1835. In the morning I came on shore early, bringing with me some provisions, in a bag, and two blankets for myself and servant. These were lashed to each end of a long pole, which was alternately carried by my Tahitian companions, on their shoulders. These men are accustomed thus to carry, for a whole day, as much as 50 pounds, at each end of their poles. I told my guides to provide themselves with food and clothing. But they said that there was plenty of food, in the mountains, and for clothing. That their skins were sufficient. Our line of march was the valley of Tauru, down which a river flows into the sea, by Point Venus. This is one of the principal streams in the island, and its source lies at the base of the loftiest central pinnacles, which rise to a height of about 7,000 feet. The whole island is so mountainous that the only way to penetrate into the interior is to follow up the valleys. Our road, at first, lay through woods which bordered each side of the river, and the glimpses of the lofty central peaks, seen as through an avenue, with here and there a waving coconut tree on one side, were extremely picturesque. The valley soon began to narrow, and the sides to grow lofty and more precipitous. After having walked between 3 and 4 hours, we found the width of the ravine scarcely exceeded that of the bed of the stream. On each hand the walls were nearly vertical, yet from the soft nature of the volcanic strata, trees and a rank vegetation sprung from every projecting ledge. These precipices must have been some 1,000 feet high, and the whole formed a mountain gorge far more magnificent than anything which I had ever before beheld. Until the midday sun stood vertically over the ravine, the air felt cool and damp, but now it became very sultry. Shaded by a ledge of rock, beneath a facade of columnar lava, we ate our dinner. My guide had already procured a dish of small fish and freshwater prawns. They carried with them a small net stretched on a hoop, and where the water was deep, and in eddies, they dived, and like otters, with their eyes open followed the fish into holes and corners, and thus caught them. The Tahitians have the dexterity of amphibious animals in the water. An anecdote mentioned by Ellis shows how much they feel at home in this element. When a horse was landing for Pomare, in 1817, the slings broke, and it fell into the water. Immediately the natives jumped overboard, and by their cries and vain efforts at assistance almost drowned it. As soon, however, as it reached the shore, the whole population took to flight, and tried to hide themselves from the man carrying Big, as they christened the horse. A little higher up, the river divided itself into three little streams. The two northern ones were impracticable, owing to a succession of waterfalls which descended from the jagged summit of the highest mountain. The other, to all appearance, was equally inaccessible, but we managed to ascend it by a most extraordinary road. The sides of the valley were here nearly precipitous, but, as frequently happens with stratified rocks, small ledges projected, which were thickly covered by wild bananas, liliaceous plants, and other luxuriant productions of the tropics. The Tahitians, by climbing amongst these ledges, searching for fruit, had discovered a track by which the whole precipice could be scaled. The first ascent from the valley was very dangerous, for it was necessary to pass a steeply inclined face of naked rock by the aid of ropes, which we brought with us. How any person discovered that this formidable spot was the only point where the side of the mountain was practicable, I cannot imagine. We then cautiously walked along one of the ledges, till we came to one of the three streams. This ledge formed a flat spot, above which a beautiful cascade, some 100 feet in height, pour down its waters, and beneath, another high cascade fell into the main stream in the valley below. From this cool and shady recess we made a circuit to avoid the overhanging waterfall. As before, we followed little projecting ledges, the danger being partly concealed by the thickness of the vegetation. In passing from one of the ledges to another there was a vertical wall of rock. One of the Tahitians, a fine active man, placed the trunk of a tree against this, climbed up it, and then by the aid of crevices reached the summit. He fixed the ropes to a projecting point, and lowered them for our dog and luggage, and then we clambered up ourselves. Beneath the ledge on which the dead tree was placed, the precipice must have been 500 or 600 feet deep, and if the abyss had not been partly concealed by the overhanging ferns and lilies my head would have turned giddy, and nothing should have induced me to have attempted it. We continued to ascend, sometimes along ledges, and sometimes along knife-etched ridges, having on each hand profound ravines. In the Cordillera, I have seen mountains on a far grander scale, but for abruptness nothing at all comparable with this. In the evening we reached a flat little spot on the banks of the same stream which we had continued to follow, and which descends in a chain of waterfalls. Here we bivouacked for the night. On each side of the ravine there were great beds of the mountain banana, covered with ripe fruit. Many of these plants were from 20 to 25 feet high, and from 3 to 4 in circumference. By the aid of strips of bark for rope, the stems of bamboos for rafters, and a large leaf of the banana for a thatch, the Tahitians, in a few minutes built us an excellent house, and with withered leaves made a soft bed. Plate 86. Fatahua Fall, Tahiti. Plate 87. Tahitian. They then proceeded to make a fire and cook our evening meal. A light was procured by rubbing a blunt-pointed stick in a groove made in another, as if with intention of deepening it, until by the friction the dust became ignited. A peculiarly white and fairy light would, the hibiscus tilaceus, is alone used for this purpose. It is the same which serves for poles, to carry any burden, and for the floating outriggers to their canoes. The fire was produced in a few seconds, but to a person who does not understand the art, it requires, as I found, the greatest exertion, but at last, to my great pride, I succeeded in igniting the dust. The gaucho in the Pampas uses a different method. Taking an elastic stick about 18 inches long, he presses one end on his breast, and the other pointed end into a hole in a piece of wood, and then rapidly turns the curved part, like a carpenter's center bit. The Tahitians, having made a small fire of sticks, placed a score of stones of about the size of cricket balls on the burning wood. In about 10 minutes the sticks were consumed, and the stones hot. They had previously folded up in small parcels of leaves, pieces of beef, fish, ripe and unripe bananas, and the tops of the wild arum. These green parcels were laid in a layer between two layers of the hot stones, and the whole then covered up with earth, so that no smoke or steam could escape. In about a quarter of an hour the whole was most deliciously cooked. The choice green parcels were now laid on a cloth of banana leaves, and with a coconut shell we drank the cool water of the running stream, and thus we enjoyed our rustic meal. I could not look on the surrounding plants without admiration. On every side were forests of bananas, the fruit of which, though serving for food in various ways, lay in heaps decaying on the ground. In front of us there was an extensive brake of wild sugar cane, and the stream was shaded by the dark green knotted stem of the ava, so famous in former days for its powerful intoxicating effects. I chewed a piece, and found that it had an acrid and unpleasant taste, which would have induced anyone at once to have pronounced it poisonous. Thanks to the missionaries, this plant now thrives only in these deep ravines, innocuous to everyone. Close by I saw the wild arum, the roots of which, when well baked, are good to eat, and the young leaves better than spinach. There was the wild yam, and a liliaceous plant called tea, which grows in abundance and has a soft brown root and shape and size like a huge log of wood. This served us for dessert, for it is as sweet as treacle and with a pleasant taste. There were, moreover, several other wild fruits and useful vegetables. The little stream, besides its cool water, produced eels and crayfish. I did indeed admire this scene when I compared it with an uncultivated one in the temperate zones. I felt the force of the remark that man, at least savage man, with his reasoning powers only partly developed, is the child of the tropics. As the evening drew to a close, I strolled beneath the gloomy shade of the bananas up the course of the stream. My walk was soon brought to a close by coming to a waterfall between 200 and 300 feet high, and again above this there was another. I mention all these waterfalls in this one brook to give a general idea of the inclination of the land. In the little recess where the water fell, it did not appear that a breath of wind had ever blown. The thin edges of the great leaves of the banana, damp with spray, were unbroken, instead of being, as is so generally the case, split into 1,000 shreds. From our position, almost suspended on the mountainside, there were glimpses into the depths of the neighboring valleys, and the lofty points of the central mountains, towering up within 60 degrees of the zenith, hid half the evening sky. Thus seated, it was a sublime spectacle to watch the shades of night gradually obscuring the last and highest pinnacles. Before we laid ourselves down to sleep, the elder Tahitian fell on his knees, and with closed eyes repeated a long prayer in his native tongue. He prayed, as a Christian should do, with fitting reverence, and without the fear of ridicule or any ostentation of piety. At our meals neither of the men would taste food without saying beforehand a short grace. Those travelers who think that a Tahitian prays only when the eyes of the missionary are fixed on him should have slept with us that night on the mountainside. Before morning it rained very heavily, but the good thatch of banana leaves kept us dry. November 19, 1835. At daylight my friends, after their morning prayer, prepared an excellent breakfast, in the same manner as in the evening. They themselves certainly partook of it largely, indeed I never saw any men eat near so much. I suppose such enormously capacious stomachs must be the effect of a large part of their diet consisting of fruit and vegetables which contain, in a given bulk, a comparatively small portion of nutriment. Unwittingly, I was the means of my companions breaking, as I afterwards learned, one of their own laws and resolutions. I took with me a flask of spirits, which they could not refuse to partake of, but as often as they drank a little, they put their fingers before their mouths and uttered the word missionary. About 2 years ago, although the use of the ava was prevented, drunkenness from the introduction of spirits became very prevalent. The missionaries prevailed on a few good men, who saw that their country was rapidly going to ruin, to join with them in a temperance society. From good sense or shame, all the chiefs and the queen were at last persuaded to join. Immediately a law was passed that no spirit should be allowed to be introduced into the island, and that he who sold and he who bought the forbidden article should be punished by a fine. With remarkable justice, a certain period was allowed for stock in hand to be sold before the law came into effect. But when it did, a general search was made, in which even the houses of the missionaries were not exempted, and all the ava, as the natives call all ardent spirits, was poured on the ground. When one reflects on the effect of intemperance on the aborigines of the two Americas, I think it will be acknowledged that every well-wisher of Tahiti owes no common debt of gratitude to the missionaries. As long as the little island of St. Helena remained under the government of the East India Company, spirits, owing to the great injury they had produced, were not allowed to be imported, but wine was supplied from the Cape of Good Hope. It is rather a striking, and not very gratifying fact, that in the same year that spirits were allowed to be sold in St. Helena, their use was banished from Tahiti by the free will of the people. After breakfast we proceeded on our journey. As my object was merely to see a little of the interior scenery, we returned by another track, which descended into the main valley lower down. For some distance we wound, by a most intricate path, along the side of the mountain which formed a valley. In the less precipitous parts we passed through extensive groves of the wild banana. The Tahitians, with their naked, tattooed bodies, their heads ornamented with flowers, and seen in the dark shade of these groves, would have formed a fine picture of man inhabiting some primeval land. In our descent we followed the line of ridges. These were exceedingly narrow, and for considerable length steep, as a ladder, but all clothed with vegetation. The extreme care necessary in poising each step rendered the walk fatiguing. I did not cease to wonder at these ravines and precipices, when viewing the country from one of the knife-edged ridges. The point of support was so small that the effect was nearly the same as it must be from a balloon. In this descent we had occasion to use the ropes only once, at the point where we entered the main valley. We slept under the same ledge of rock where we had dined the day before. The night was fine, but from the depth and narrowness of the gorge, profoundly dark. Before actually seeing this country, I found it difficult to understand two facts mentioned by Ellis, namely, that after the murderous battles of former times, the survivors on the conquered side retired into the mountains, where a handful of men could resist a multitude. Certainly half a dozen men, at the spot where the Tahitian reared the old tree, could easily have repulsed thousands. Secondly, that after the introduction of Christianity, there were wild men who lived in the mountains, and whose retreats were unknown to the more civilized inhabitants. November 20, 1835. In the morning we started early, and reached Matave, at noon. On the road we met a large party of noble athletic men, going for wild bananas. I found that the ship, on account of the difficulty in watering, had moved to the harbor of Tapawa, to which place I immediately walked. This is a very pretty spot. The cove is surrounded by reefs, and the water as smooth as in a lake. The cultivated ground, with its beautiful productions, interspersed with cottages, comes close down to the water's edge. From the varying accounts which I had read before reaching these islands, I was very anxious to form, from my own observation, a judgment of their moral state, although such judgment would necessarily be very imperfect. First impressions at all times very much depend on one's previously acquired ideas. My notions were drawn from Ellis's Polynesian Researches, an admirable and most interesting work, but naturally looking at everything under a favorable point of view, from Beechey's voyage, and from that of Cott's view, which is strongly adverse to the whole missionary system. He who compares these three accounts will, I think, form a tolerably accurate conception of the present state of Tahiti. One of my impressions, which I took from the two last authorities, was decidedly incorrect, namely, that the Tahitians had become a gloomy race, and lived in fear of the missionaries. Of the latter feeling I saw no trace, unless, indeed, fear and respect be confounded under one name. Instead of discontent being a common feeling, it would be difficult in Europe to pick out of a crowd half so many merry and happy faces. The prohibition of the flute and dancing is inveighed against as wrong and foolish. The more than Presbyterian manner of keeping the Sabbath is looked at in a similar light. On these points I will not pretend to offer any opinion, in opposition to men who have resided as many years as I was days on the island. On the whole, it appears to me that the morality and religion of the inhabitants are highly creditable. There are many who attack, even more acrimoniously than Kotzebue, both the missionaries, their system, and the effects produced by it. Such reasoners never compare the present state with that of the island only 20 years ago, nor even with that of Europe, at this day, but they compare it with the high standard of gospel perfection. They expect the missionaries to effect that which the apostles themselves failed to do. Inasmuch as the condition of the people falls short of this high standard, blame is attached to the missionary, instead of credit for that which he has effected. They forget, or will not remember, that human sacrifices, and the power of an idolatrous priesthood, a system of profligacy unparalleled in any other part of the world, infanticide a consequence of that system, bloody wars, where the conquerors spared neither women nor children, that all these have been abolished, and that dishonesty, intemperance, and licentiousness have been greatly reduced by the introduction of Christianity. In a voyager to forget these things is base ingratitude, for should he chance to be at the point of shipwreck on some unknown coast, he will most devoutly pray that the lesson of the missionary may have extended thus far. In point of morality, the virtue of the women, it has been often said, is most open to exception. But before they are blamed too severely, it will be well distinctly to call to mind the scenes described by Captain Cook and Mr. Banks, in which the grandmothers and mothers of the present race played a part. Those who are most severe should consider how much of the morality of the women in Europe is owing to the system early impressed by mothers on their daughters, and how much in each individual case to the precepts of religion. But it is useless to argue against such reasoners. I believe that, disappointed in not finding the field of licentiousness quite so open as formerly, they will not give credit to a morality which they do not wish to practice, or to a religion which they undervalue, if not despise. Sunday, November 22, 1835. The harbor of Papeete, where the Queen resides, may be considered as the capital of the island. It is also the seat of government, and the chief resort of shipping. Captain Fitzroy took a party there this day, to hear divine service, first in the Tahitian language, and afterwards in our own. Mr. Pritchard, the leading missionary in the island, performed the service. The chapel consisted of a large airy framework of wood, and it was filled to excess by tidy, clean people, of all ages, and both sexes. I was rather disappointed in the apparent degree of attention, but I believe my expectations were raised too high. At all events, the appearance was quite equal to that in a country church in England. The singing of the hymns was decidedly very pleasing. But the language from the pulpit, although fluently delivered, did not sound well. A constant repetition of words, like tatata, matamite, rendered it monotonous. After English service, a party returned on foot to Matave. It was a pleasant walk, sometimes along the sea beach, and sometimes under the shade of the many beautiful trees. About 2 years ago, a small vessel under English colors was plundered by some of the inhabitants of the Low Islands, which were then under the dominion of the Queen of Tahiti. It was believed that the perpetrators were instigated to this act by some indiscreet laws issued by Her Majesty. The British government demanded compensation, which was acceded to, and a sum of nearly $3,000 was agreed to be paid on the 1st of last September. The Commodore at Lima ordered Captain Fitzroy to inquire concerning this debt, and to demand satisfaction, if it were not paid. Captain Fitzroy accordingly requested an interview with the Queen Pomare, since famous from the ill treatment she has received from the French, and a parliament was held to consider the question, at which all the principal chiefs of the island and the Queen were assembled. I will not attempt to describe what took place after the interesting account given by Captain Fitzroy. The money, it appeared, had not been paid. Perhaps the alleged reasons were rather equivocal, but otherwise I cannot sufficiently express our general surprise at the extreme good sense, the reasoning powers, moderation, candor, and prompt resolution, which were displayed on all sides. I believe we all left the meeting with a very different opinion of the Tahitians from what we entertained when we entered. The chiefs and people resolved to subscribe and complete the sum which was wanting. Captain Fitzroy urged that it was hard that their private property should be sacrificed for the crimes of distant islanders. They replied that they were grateful for his consideration, but that Pumare was their queen, and that they were determined to help her in this her difficulty. This resolution and its prompt execution, for a book was opened early the next morning, made a perfect conclusion to this very remarkable scene of loyalty and good feeling. After the main discussion was ended, several of the chiefs took the opportunity of asking Captain Fitzroy many intelligent questions on international customs and laws relating to the treatment of ships and foreigners. On some points, as soon as the decision was made, the law was issued verbally on the spot. The Tahitian Parliament lasted for several hours, and when it was over, Captain Fitzroy invited Queen Pumare to pay the beagle a visit. November 25, 1835. In the evening, four boats were sent for Her Majesty. The ship was dressed with flags, and the yards manned on her coming on board. She was accompanied by most of the chiefs. The behavior of all was very proper. They begged for nothing, and seemed much pleased with Captain Fitzroy's presence. The Queen is a large, awkward woman, without any beauty, grace, or dignity. She has only one royal attribute, a perfect immovability of expression, under all circumstances, and that rather a sullen one. The rockets were most admired, and a depot could be heard from the shore, around the dark bay, after each explosion. The sailors' songs were also much admired, and the Queen said she thought that one of the most boisterous ones certainly could not be a hymn. The royal party did not return on shore till past midnight. November 26, 1835. In the evening, with a gentle land breeze, a course was steered for New Zealand, and, as the sun set, we had a farewell view of the mountains of Tahiti, the island to which every voyager has offered up his tribute of admiration. December 19, 1835. In the evening we saw in the distance New Zealand. We may now consider that we have nearly crossed the Pacific. It is necessary to sail over this great ocean to comprehend its immensity. Moving quickly onwards 4 weeks together, we meet with nothing but the same blue, profoundly deep, ocean. Even within the archipelagos, the islands are mere specks, and far distant one from the other. Accustomed to look at maps drawn on a small scale, where dots, shading, and names are crowded together, we do not rightly judge how infinitely small the proportion of dry land is to the water of this vast expanse. The meridian of the Antipodes has likewise been passed, and now every league, it made us happy to think, was one league nearer to England. These Antipodes call to one's mind old recollections of childish doubt and wonder. Only the other day I looked forward to this airy barrier as a definite point in our voyage homewards, but now I find it, and all such resting places for the imagination, are like shadows which a man moving onwards cannot catch. A gale of wind lasting for some days has lately given us full leisure to measure the future stages in our homeward voyage, and to wish most earnestly for its termination. December 21, 1835. Early in the morning we entered the Bay of Islands, and being becalmed for some hours near the mouth, we did not reach the anchorage till the middle of the day. The country is hilly, with a smooth outline, and is deeply intersected by numerous arms of the sea, extending from the bay. The surface appears from a distance, as if clothed with coarse pasture, but this in truth is nothing but fern. On the more distant hills, as well as in parts of the valleys, there is a good deal of woodland. The general tint of the landscape is not a bright green, and it resembles the country a short distance to the south of Concepcion in Chile. In several parts of the bay, little villages of squared ideal-looking houses are scattered close down to the water's edge. Three whaling ships were lying at anchor, and a canoe every now and then crossed from shore to shore. With these exceptions, an air of extreme quietness reigned over the whole district. Only a single canoe came alongside. This, and the aspect of the whole scene, afforded a remarkable, and not very pleasing contrast, with our joyful and boisterous welcome at Tahiti. In the afternoon, we went on shore to one of the larger groups of houses, which yet hardly deserves the title of a village. Its name is Bahia. It is the residence of the missionaries, and there are no native residents except servants and laborers. In the vicinity of the Bay of Islands, the number of Englishmen, including their families, amounts to between 200 and 300. All the cottages, many of which are whitewashed, and look very neat, are the property of the English. The hovels of the natives are so diminutive and paltry that they can scarcely be perceived from a distance. At Bahia it was quite pleasing to behold the English flowers in the gardens, before the houses. There were roses of several kinds, honeysuckle, jasmine, stocks, and whole hedges of sweetbriar. December 22, 1835. In the morning I went out walking, but I soon found that the country was very impracticable. All the hills are thickly covered with tall fern, together with a low bush which grows like a cypress, and very little ground has been cleared or cultivated. I then tried the sea beach, but proceeding towards either hand, my walk was soon stopped by saltwater creeks and deep brooks. The communication between the inhabitants of the different parts of the bay is, as in Chile, almost entirely kept up by boats. I was surprised to find that almost every hill which I ascended had been at some former time more or less fortified. The summits were cut in two steps, or successive terraces, and frequently they had been protected by deep trenches. I afterwards observed that the principal hills inland in like manner showed an artificial outline. These are the Pars, so frequently mentioned by Captain Cook, under the name of Hippa, the difference of sound being owing to the prefixed article. That the Pa had formerly been much used was evident from the piles of shells, and the pits in which, as I was informed, sweet potatoes used to be kept, as a reserve. As there was no water on these hills, the defenders could never have anticipated a long siege, but only a hurried attack for plunder, against which the successive terraces would have afforded good protection. The general introduction of firearms has changed the whole system of warfare, and an exposed situation on the top of a hill is now worse than useless. The Pa in consequence are, at the present day, always built on a level piece of ground. They consist of a double stockade of thick and tall posts, placed in a zigzag line, so that every part can be flanked. Within the stockade a mound of earth is thrown up, behind which the defenders can rest in safety, or use their firearms over it. On the level of the ground little archways sometimes pass through this breastwork, by which means the defenders can crawl out to the stockade and reconnoiter their enemies. The Reverend W. Williams, who gave me this account, added that in one Pa he had noticed spurs or buttresses projecting on the inner and protected side of the mound of earth. On asking the chief the use of them, he replied that if two or three of his men were shot their neighbors would not see the bodies, and so be discouraged. These par considered by the New Zealanders as very perfect means of defense, for the attacking forces never so well disciplined as to rush in a body to the stockade, cut it down, and effect their entry. When a tribe goes to war, the chief cannot order one party to go here and another there, but every man fights in the manner which best pleases himself, and to each separate individual, to approach a stockade defended by firearms must appear certain death. I should think a more warlike race of inhabitants could not be found in any part of the world than the New Zealanders. Their conduct on first seeing a ship, as described by Captain Cook, strongly illustrates this, the act of throwing volleys of stones at so great and novel an object, and their defiance of, "Come on shore, and we will kill, and eat you all," shows uncommon boldness. This warlike spirit is evident in many of their customs, and even in their smallest actions. If a New Zealander is struck, although but in joke, the blow must be returned, and of this I saw an instance with one of our officers. At the present day, from the progress of civilization, there is much less warfare, except among some of the southern tribes. I heard a characteristic anecdote of what took place some time ago in the south. A missionary found a chief and his tribe in preparation for war, their muskets clean and bright, and their ammunition ready. He reasoned long on the inutility of the war, and the little provocation which had been given for it. The chief was much shaken in his resolution, and seemed in doubt, but at length it occurred to him that a barrel of his gunpowder was in a bad state, and that it would not keep much longer. This was brought forward as an unanswerable argument for the necessity of immediately declaring war. The idea of allowing so much good gunpowder to spoil was not to be thought of, and this settled the point. I was told by the missionaries that in the life of Shongi, the chief who visited England, the love of war was the one and lasting spring of every action. The tribe in which he was a principal chief had at one time been much oppressed by another tribe from the Thames River. A solemn oath was taken by the men that, when their boys should grow up, and they should be powerful enough, they would never forget or forgive these injuries. To fulfill this oath appears to have been Shongis's chief motive for going to England, and when there it was his sole object. Presents were valued only as they could be converted into arms of the arts, those alone interested him which were connected with the manufacture of arms. When at Sydney, Shongi, by a strange coincidence, met the hostile chief of the Thames River at the house of Mr. Marsden. Their conduct was civil to each other, but Shongi told him that when again in New Zealand he would never cease to carry war into his country. The challenge was accepted, and Shongi, on his return, fulfilled the threat to the utmost letter. The tribe on the Thames River was utterly overthrown, and the chief to whom the challenge had been given was himself killed. Shongi, although harboring such deep feelings of hatred and revenge, is described as having been a good-natured person. In the evening I went with Captain Fitzroy and Mr. Baker, one of the missionaries, to pay a visit to Koro Radika. We wandered about the village, and saw, and conversed with many of the people, both men, women, and children. Looking at the New Zealander, one naturally compares him with the Tahitian, both belonging to the same family of mankind. The comparison, however, tells heavily against the New Zealander. He may, perhaps, be superior in energy, but in every other respect his character is of a much lower order. One glance at their respective expressions brings conviction to the mind that one is a savage, the other a civilized man. It would be vain to seek in the whole of New Zealand a person with the face and mien of the old Tahitian chief Utama. No doubt the extraordinary manner in which tattooing is here practiced gives a disagreeable expression to their countenances. The complicated but symmetrical figures covering the whole face puzzle and mislead an unaccustomed eye. It is moreover probable that the deep incisions, By destroying the play of the superficial muscles, give an air of rigid inflexibility. But, besides this, there is a twinkling in the eye which cannot indicate anything but cunning and ferocity. Their figures are tall and bulky, but not comparable in elegance with those of the working classes in Tahiti. Both their persons and houses are filthily dirty and offensive. The idea of washing either their bodies or their clothes never seems to enter their heads. I saw a chief who was wearing a shirt black and matted with filth, and when asked how it came to be so dirty, he replied, with surprise, "Do not use it as an old one. Some of the men have shirts, but the common dress is one or two large blankets, generally black with dirt, which are thrown over their shoulders, in a very inconvenient and awkward fashion. A few of the principal chiefs have decent suits of English clothes, but these are only worn on great occasions." December 23, 1835. At a place called Waymate, about 15 miles from the Bay of Islands, and midway between the eastern and western coasts, the missionaries have purchased some land for agricultural purposes. I had been introduced to the Reverend W. Williams, who, upon my expressing a wish, invited me to pay him a visit there. Mr. Bushby, the British resident, offered to take me in his boat by a creek, where I should see a pretty waterfall, and by which means my walk would be shortened. He likewise procured for me a guide. Upon asking a neighboring chief to recommend a man, the chief himself offered to go, but his ignorance of the value of money was so complete that at first he asked how many pounds I would give him, but afterwards was well contented with $2. When I showed the chief a very small bundle which I wanted carried, it became absolutely necessary for him to take this leave. These feelings of pride are beginning to wear away. But formerly a leading man would sooner have died than undergone the indignity of carrying the smallest burden. My companion was a light, active man, dressed in a dirty blanket, and with his face completely tattooed. He had formerly been a great warrior. He appeared to be on very cordial terms with Mr. Bushby, but at various times they had quarreled violently. Mr. Bushby remarked that a little quiet tyranny would frequently silence any one of these natives in their most blustering moments. This chief has come and harangued Mr. Bushby in a hectoring manner, saying, "A great chief, a great man, a friend of mine, has come to pay me a visit. You must give him something good to eat, some fine presents, etc." Mr. Bushby has allowed him to finish his discourse, and then has quietly replied by some answer such as, "What else shall your slave do for you?" The man would then instantly, with a very comical expression, cease his braggadocio. Some time ago Mr. Bushby suffered a far more serious attack. A chief and a party of men tried to break into his house in the middle of the night, and not finding this so easy, commenced to brisk firing with their muskets. Mr. Bushby was slightly wounded, but the party was at length driven away. Shortly afterwards it was discovered who was the aggressor, and a general meeting of the chiefs was convened to consider the case. It was considered by the New Zealanders as very atrocious, inasmuch as it was a night attack, and that Mrs. Bushby was lying ill in the house. This latter circumstance, much to their honor, being considered in all cases as a protection. The chiefs agreed to confiscate the land of the aggressor to the King of England. The whole proceeding, however, in thus trying and punishing a chief was entirely without precedent. The aggressor, moreover, lost caste in the estimation of his equals, and this was considered by the British as of more consequence than the confiscation of his land. As the boat was shoving off, a second chief stepped into her, who only wanted the amusement of the passage up and down the creek. I never saw a more horrid and ferocious expression than this man had. It immediately struck me I had somewhere seen his likeness, It will be found in Resch's outlines to Schiller's Ballad of Fridolin, where two men are pushing Robert into the burning iron furnace. It is the man who has his arm on Robert's breast. Physiognomy here spoke the truth. This chief had been a notorious murderer, and was an arrant coward to boot. At the point where the boat landed, Mr. Bushby accompanied me a few hundred yards on the road. I could not help admiring the cool impudence of the hoary, old villain, whom we left lying in the boat, when he shouted to Mr. Bushby, "Do not you stay long, I shall be tired of waiting here." We now commenced our walk. The road lay along a well-beaten path, bordered on each side by the Dolphin, which covers the whole country. After traveling some miles we came to a little country village, where a few hovels were collected together, and some patches of ground cultivated with potatoes. The introduction of the potato has been the most essential benefit to the island. It is now much more used than any native vegetable. New Zealand is favored by one great natural advantage, namely, that the inhabitants can never perish from famine. The whole country abounds with fern, and the roots of this plant, if not very palatable, yet contain much nutriment. A native can always subsist on these, and on the shellfish which are abundant on all parts of the sea coast. The villages are chiefly conspicuous by the platforms which are raised on four posts, 10 or 12 feet, above the ground, and on which the produce of the fields is kept secure from all accidents. On coming near one of the huts I was much amused by seeing in due form the ceremony of rubbing, or, as it ought to be called, pressing noses. The women, on our first approach, began uttering something in a most dolorous voice. They then squatted themselves down and held up their faces, my companion standing over them. One after another, placed the bridge of his nose at right angles to theirs, and commenced pressing. This lasted rather longer than a cordial shake of the hand with us, and, as we vary the force of the grasp of the hand in shaking, so do they in pressing. During the process they uttered comfortable little grunts, very much in the same manner as two pigs do, when rubbing against each other. I noticed that the slave would press noses with anyone he met, indifferently either before or after his master the chief. Although among these savages the chief has absolute power of life and death over his slave, yet there is an entire absence of ceremony between them. Mr. Burchell has remarked the same thing in southern Africa with the rude Bakopans, where civilization has arrived at a certain point. Complex formalities soon arise between the different grades of society. Thus at Tahiti all were formerly obliged to uncover themselves as low as the waist in presence of the king. The ceremony of pressing noses having been duly completed with all present, we seated ourselves in a circle in the front of one of the hovels and rested there half an hour. All the hovels have nearly the same form and dimensions, and all agree in being filthily dirty. They resemble a cow shed with one end open, but having a partition a little way within, with a square hole in it, making a small gloomy chamber. In this the inhabitants keep all their property, and when the weather is cold they sleep there. They eat, however, and pass their time in the open part in front. My guide having finished their pipes, we continued our walk. The path led through the same undulating country, the whole uniformly clothed, as before, with fern. On our right hand we had the Serpentine River, the banks of which were fringed with trees, and here and there on the hillsides, there was a clump of wood. The whole scene, in spite of its green color, had rather a desolate aspect. The sight of so much fern impresses the mind with an idea of sterility. This, however, is not correct, for wherever the fern grows thick and breast high, the land by tillage becomes productive. Some of the residents think that all this extensive open country originally was covered with forests, and that it has been cleared by fire. It is said that by digging in the bare spots, lumps of the kind of resin which flows from the kauri pine are frequently found. The natives had an evident motive in clearing the country for the fern. Formerly a staple article of food, flourishes only in the open cleared tracts. The almost entire absence of associated grasses, which form so remarkable a feature in the vegetation of this island, may perhaps be accounted for by the land having been aboriginally covered with forest trees. The soil is volcanic, in several parts we passed over slaggy lavas, and craters could clearly be distinguished on several of the neighboring hills. Although the scenery is nowhere beautiful, and only occasionally pretty, I enjoyed my walk. I should have enjoyed it more, if my companion, the chief, had not possessed extraordinary conversational powers. I knew only three words, good, bad, and yes, and with these I answered all his remarks, without of course having understood one word he said. This, however, was quite sufficient. I was a good listener, an agreeable person, and he never ceased talking to me. At length we reached Waymate. After having passed over so many miles of an uninhabited useless country, the sudden appearance of an English farmhouse, and its well-dressed fields, placed there, as if by an enchanter's wand, was exceedingly pleasant. Mr. Williams not being at home, I received in Mr. Davies' house a cordial welcome. After drinking tea with his family pretty, we took a stroll about the farm. At Waymate there are three large houses, where the missionary gentlemen, Messrs. Williams, Davies, and Clark, reside, and near them are the huts of the native laborers. On an adjoining slope fine crops of barley and wheat were standing in full ear, and in another part, fields of potatoes and clover. But I cannot attempt to describe all I saw. There were large gardens, with every fruit and vegetable which England produces, and many belonging to a warmer clime. I may instance asparagus, kidney beans, cucumbers, rhubarb, apples, pears, figs, peaches, apricots, grapes, olives, gooseberries, currants, hops, gorse for fences, and English oaks, also many kinds of flowers. Around the farmyard there were stables, a thrashing barn, with its winnowing machine, a blacksmith's forge, and on the ground plowshares, and other tools. In the middle was that happy mixture of pigs and poultry, lying comfortably together, as in every English farmyard. At the distance of a few hundred yards, where the water of a little rill had been dammed up into a pool, there was a large and substantial water mill. All this is very surprising. When it is considered that 5 years ago nothing but the fern flourished here. Moreover, native workmanship, taught by the missionaries, has effected this change. The lesson of the missionary is the enchanter's wand. The house had been built, the windows framed, the fields plowed, and even the trees grafted, by the New Zealander. At the mill a New Zealander was seen powdered white with flour, like his brother miller in England. When I looked at this whole scene I thought it admirable. It was not merely that England was brought vividly before my mind, yet, as the evening drew to a close, the domestic sounds, the fields of corn, the distant undulating country with its trees, might well have been mistaken for our fatherland, nor was it the triumphant feeling at seeing what Englishmen could effect, but rather the high hopes us inspired for the future progress of this fine island. Several young men, redeemed by the missionaries from slavery, were employed on the farm. They were dressed in a shirt, jacket, and trousers, and had a respectable appearance. Judging from one trifling anecdote, I should think they must be honest. When walking in the fields, a young laborer came up to Mr. Davies and gave him a knife and gimlet, saying that he had found them on the road and did not know to whom they belonged. These young men and boys appeared very merry and good-humored. In the evening I saw a party of them at cricket, When I thought of the austerity of which the missionaries have been accused, I was amused by observing one of their own sons taking an active part in the game. A more decided and pleasing change was manifested in the young women, who acted as servants within the houses. Their clean, tidy, and healthy appearance, like that of the dairy maids in England, formed a wonderful contrast with the women of the filthy hovels in Coro Rodica. The wives of the missionaries tried to persuade them not to be tattooed, but a famous operator having arrived from the south, they said, "We really must just have a few lines on our lips, else when we grow old, our lips will shrivel, and we shall be so very ugly." There is not nearly so much tattooing as formerly, but, as it is a badge of distinction between the chief and the slave, it will probably long be practiced. So soon does any train of ideas become habitual, that the missionaries told me that even in their eyes, a plain face looked mean, and not like that of a New Zealand gentleman. Late in the evening I went to Mr. Williams's house, where I passed the night. I found there a large party of children, collected together for Christmas Day, and all sitting round a table at tea. I never saw a nicer or more merry group, and to think that this was in the center of the land of cannibalism, murder, and all atrocious crimes. The cordiality and happiness so plainly pictured in the faces of the little circle appeared equally felt by the older persons of the mission. December 24, 1835. In the morning prayers were read in the native tongue to the whole family. After breakfast I rambled about the gardens and farm. This was a market day, when the natives of the surrounding hamlets bring their potatoes, Indian corn, or pigs, to exchange for blankets, tobacco, and sometimes, through the persuasions of the missionaries, for soap. Mr. Davies' eldest son, who manages a farm of his own, is the man of business in the market. The children of the missionaries, who came while young to the island, understand the language better than their parents, and can get anything more readily done by the natives. A little before noon, Messrs. Williams and Davies walked with me to part of a neighboring forest, to show me the famous Cowrie Pine. I measured one of these noble trees, and found it 31 feet in circumference, above the roots. There was another close by, which I did not see, 33 feet, and I heard of one no less than 40 feet. These trees are remarkable for their smooth cylindrical boles, which run up to a height of 60, and even 90 feet, with a nearly equal diameter, and without a single branch. The crown of branches at the summit is out of all proportion small to the trunk, and the leaves are likewise small compared with the branches. The forest was here almost composed of the cowrie, and the largest trees, from the parallelism of their sides, stood up, like gigantic columns of wood. The timber of the cowrie is the most valuable production of the island. Moreover, a quantity of resin oozes from the bark, which is sold at a penny a pound to the Americans, but its use was then unknown. Some of the New Zealand forests must be impenetrable to an extraordinary degree. Mr. Matthews informed me that one forest only 34 miles in width, and separating two inhabited districts, had only lately, for the first time, been crossed. He and another missionary, each with a party of about 50 men, undertook to open a road, but it cost them more than a fortnight's labor. In the woods I saw very few birds. With regard to animals, it is a most remarkable fact that so large an island, extending over more than 700 miles in latitude, and in many parts 90 broad, with varied stations, a fine climate, and land of all heights, from 14,000 feet downwards, with the exception of a small rat, did not possess one indigenous animal. The several species of that gigantic genus of birds, the Deinornis, seem here to have replaced mammiferous quadrupeds, in the same manner as the reptiles still do at the Galapagos Archipelago. It is said that the common Norway rat, in the short space of 2 years, annihilated in this northern end of the island the New Zealand species. In many places I noticed several sorts of weeds, which, like the rats, I was forced to own as countrymen. A leak has overrun whole districts, and will prove very troublesome, but it was imported as a favor by a French vessel. The common dock is also widely disseminated, and will, I fear, forever remain a proof of the rascality of an Englishman who sold the seeds for those of the tobacco plant. On returning from our pleasant walk to the house, I dined with Mr. Williams, and then, a horse being lent me, I returned to the Bay of Islands. I took leave of the missionaries with thankfulness for their kind welcome, and with feelings of high respect for their gentlemanlike, useful, and upright characters. I think it would be difficult to find a body of men better adapted for the high office which they fulfill. Christmas Day, 1835. In a few more days the 4th year of our absence from England will be completed. Our first Christmas Day was spent at Plymouth, the 2nd at St. Martin's Cove near Cape Horn, the 3rd at Port Desire in Patagonia, the 4th at Anchor, in a wild harbor, in the peninsula of Tres Montes, the 5th here, and the next, I trust in Providence, will be in England. We attended divine service in the chapel of Bahia, part of the service being read in English, and part, in the native language. Whilst at New Zealand we did not hear of any recent acts of cannibalism, but Mr. Stokes found burnt human bones strewed round a fireplace on a small island near the anchorage, but these remains of a comfortable banquet might have been lying there for several years. It is probable that the moral state of the people will rapidly improve. Mr. Bushby mentioned one pleasing anecdote, as a proof of the sincerity of some, at least, of those who profess Christianity. One of his young men left him, who had been accustomed to read prayers to the rest of the servants. Some weeks afterwards, happening to pass late in the evening by an outhouse, he saw and heard one of his men reading the Bible with difficulty by the light of the fire, to the others. After this the party knelt, and prayed. In their prayers they mentioned Mr. Bushby, and his family, and the missionaries, each separately in his respective district. December 26, 1835. Mr. Bushby offered to take Mr. Sullivan, and myself in his boat some miles up the river to Kawakawa, and proposed afterwards to walk on to the village of Waiomio, where there are some curious rocks. Following one of the arms of the bay we enjoyed a pleasant row, and passed through pretty scenery, until we came to a village, beyond which the boat could not pass. From this place a chief and a party of men volunteered to walk with us to Waiomio, a distance of 4 miles. The chief was at this time rather notorious from having lately hung one of his wives, and a slave for adultery. When one of the missionaries remonstrated with him he seemed surprised, and said he thought he was exactly following the English method. Old Shongi, who happened to be in England, during the Queen's trial, expressed great disapprobation at the whole proceeding. He said he had 5 wives, and he would rather cut off all their heads than be so much troubled about one. Leaving this village, we crossed over to another, seated on a hillside, at a little distance. The daughter of a chief, who was still a heathen, had died there 5 days before. The hovel in which she had expired had been burnt to the ground. Her body, being enclosed between 2 small canoes, was placed upright on the ground, and protected by an enclosure bearing wooden images of their gods, and the whole was painted bright red, so as to be conspicuous from afar. Her gown was fastened to the coffin, and her hair being cut off was cast at its foot. The relatives of the family had torn the flesh of their arms, bodies, and faces, so that they were covered with clotted blood, and the old women looked most filthy, disgusting objects. On the following day, some of the officers visited this place and found the women still howling and cutting themselves. We continued our walk and soon reached Waiomio. Here there are some singular masses of limestone resembling ruined castles. These rocks have long served for burial places, and in consequence are held too sacred to be approached. One of the young men, however, cried out, "Let us all be brave," and ran on ahead, but when within 100 yards, the whole party thought better of it and stopped short. With perfect indifference, however, they allowed us to examine the whole place. At this village we rested some hours, during which time there was a long discussion with Mr. Bushby concerning the right of sale of certain lands. One old man, who appeared a perfect genealogist, illustrated the success of possessors by bits of stick driven into the ground. Before leaving the houses, a little basket full of roasted sweet potatoes was given to each of our party, and we all, according to the custom, carried them away to eat on the road. I noticed that among the women employed in cooking, there was a man slave. It must be a humiliating thing for a man in this warlike country to be employed in doing that which is considered as the lowest woman's work. Slaves are not allowed to go to war, but this perhaps can hardly be considered as a hardship. I heard of one poor wretch who, during hostilities, ran away to the opposite party. Being met by two men, he was immediately seized, but, as they could not agree to whom he should belong, each stood over him with a stone hatchet, and seemed determined that the other at least should not take him away alive. The poor man, almost dead with fright, was only saved by the address of a chief's wife. We afterwards enjoyed a pleasant walk back to the boat, but did not reach the ship till late in the evening. December 30, 1835. In the afternoon we stood out of the Bay of Islands, on our course to Sydney. I believe we were all glad to leave New Zealand. It is not a pleasant place. Amongst the natives there is absent that charming simplicity which is found in Tahiti, and the greater part of the English are the very refuse of society. Neither is the country itself attractive. I look back but to one bright spot, and that is Waimate, with its Christian inhabitants. The end of chapter 18.